even grimmer than usual. He realized he had been virtually raving.
Well, we can drive over there tomorrow morning, first light, right?
The Russian shook his head.
Not right. We have been ordered to return to the base.
Ordered? By whom? When?
This afternoon, while you were down in the climbing rig. The order came over the command frequency. I heard it in my suit. Dr. Lee himself specifically ordered us to return to the base camp. There has been an accident.
Mars Orbit. Deimos.
It looks good enough to eat,
quipped Leonid Tobukhin.
Like a big potato.
Isoroku Konoye said nothing. The Japanese geochemist felt strangely tense as he and the cosmonaut approached the lumpy, irregular blob of the Martian moon Deimos. To the Russian, it might look like something to eat. To him, it seemed like a huge, brooding mass of darkness, evil, and dangerous. Mars has two moons, tiny chunks of rock named Phobos and Deimos, fear and dread, fitting companions for the god of war. At first glance, the moons of Mars do look rather like battered potatoes. Neither of them is round. They are too small to have been subjected to the forces that turn a lump of stone and metal into a spherical shape. Both are deeply pitted from meteorite strikes. Phobos is streaked with inexplicable striations, grooves that look almost as if its rocky surface had been scored by the claws of a titanic beast. Deimos, the smaller of the two, is about the size of Manhattan Island, roughly 10 by 12 by 16 kilometers. It orbits just over 20,000 kilometers above the surface of Mars. From the ground, it looks like a very bright star that hangs in the sky for 2.5 sols before dipping below the horizon. Phobos is 20 by 23 by 28 kilometers and orbits much closer to its planet, less than 6,000 kilometers above the surface. It crosses the Martian sky in only 4.5 hours, hurtling from west to east like an artificial satellite, which it was once suspected to be, and rising again about 6.5 hours later. It is believed that Deimos and Phobos were originally asteroids, perhaps members of the great belt of minor chunks of rock and metal that orbits between Mars and the giant planet Jupiter. Eons ago, they drifted close enough to be captured by the red planet's gravitational field and fall into satellite orbits around it. Thus, studying Phobos and Deimos can teach us much about the farther asteroids. Most of the meteorites that have hit the Earth were originally asteroids. The Martian moons resemble the type of meteorites called by astronomers carbonaceous chondrites. Such meteorites have been found to contain not only carbon compounds, but water, locked in chemical combinations called hydrates within the meteorite's rocky materials. If the moons of Mars are rich in hydrates and carbon compounds, even though the water is not in liquid form, biologists will want to study the moons for signs of life or its precursors. Hydrates are immeasurably valuable to astronautical engineers as well. They could supply life-giving water and oxygen. More important, water can be split into hydrogen and oxygen, which can be used for rocket propellants, which could cut in half the tonnages needed to be sent off Earth for any future missions to Mars. The tiny moons of Mars, then, could become oases for space travelers where they can refresh life support supplies and refuel rocket engines, if they contain hydrates. Which is why the Japanese geochemist and the Russian cosmonaut had left the Mars 2 spacecraft to begin the hands-on study of Deimos. Tolbukhin said into his helmet microphone,
5 minutes to impact. I am arming the penetrator.
This was a rocket-powered grappling hook designed to embed itself into Deimos' pitted surface and anchor the two men safely. Without it to tether them, the explorers could go flying off the tiny moon with every step they took. Deimos' gravity was so negligibly low. Still, Konoye said nothing. He was no longer looking at the looming dark shape of Deimos. He stared instead at the enormous bulk of the red planet hanging overhead. He could not take his eyes off it. The two men had left the Mars 2 spacecraft an hour earlier, decked in hard-shell pressure suits and tubular metal frames of mobility units wrapped around their bodies. They looked like brightly colored fat robots stuck inside individual jungle gyms. The mobility units contained personal equipment, life support systems, and the thrust motors and propellants that allowed them to fly from the orbiting spacecraft to the Martian moon, named after the Greek word for dread. Slowly revolving a few kilometers away, the tethered Mars 1 and Mars 2 spacecraft looked like miniature models, white and silent, lifeless, and desperately far off. To Kanoye, Deimos was an ugly, irregular, dark gray lump of crater-pitted stone, blotting out the stars, covering half the sky. Enormous. Menacing. And Mars itself seemed terrifyingly huge, crushingly massive. In his perspective, the ponderous enormity of the red planet loomed above him, glowering overhead, pressing down, squeezing the breath from his lungs. The three immense volcanoes of the Tharsis Bulge and the even bigger caldera of Olympus Mons seemed to be staring down at him like the four monstrous, wide, round eyes of a demon, staring balefully. The Japanese geophysicist had trained for this moment for more than 3 years. He had gone through all the simulations on Earth and experienced long weeks of zero gravity aboard the space stations in Earth orbit. He had prepared himself thoroughly to lead the first-hand study of Mars's two moons. Waiting for their turns behind him were a Russian geologist and an American geophysicist, but in this moment, Japan was first. Yet Kanoye had not reckoned on that enormous expanse of red looming above him like a powerful, palpable force. This was no simulation. Mars hung over him, and he could feel it squeezing down on him while its many-eyed demon glared at him, angry and demanding. Something in his childhood awakened and began screaming. Some long-forgotten nightmare tore at his mind. He had to get away. Get away! Blindly, Kanoye fired the thrusters of his excursion unit. In panic, he fled from the overpowering presence of Mars.
Wait!
Shouted Tolbukhin.
What are you doing?
Kanoye was jetting away from Mars, away from Deimos, away from the spacecraft in which he had lived for more than 9 months. His gloved hands clamped rigidly on the thruster controls, like a catatonic or a man already in rigor mortis.
Stop!
Tolbukhin yelled, so agitated he lapsed into Russian.
You fool, you'll kill yourself!
But Kanoye was fleeing, panic-stricken, unable to speak. The cosmonaut punched his own thrusters into life and jetted after him, even as his helmet earphones erupted in wild commands from the team in the Mars 2 spacecraft monitoring their excursion. Under the remorseless hand of blind nature, Kanoye had turned himself into a miniature asteroid. At full thrust, the propellants in his tanks quickly ran out. In the frictionless vacuum of space, he continued to fly away in the same direction, straight out into the endless void between worlds. Tolbukhin could not catch him. Within a few seconds, his training asserted itself, abetted by the frenzied shouts of the monitoring team in his helmet earphones. He reversed course and headed back for the safety of the Mars 2 craft. It took no more than 2 hours for the rescue team to reach Kanoye in one of the emergency transfer vehicles they all referred to as tugboats. The Japanese scientist still had several hours of air in his suit tanks. His heater and other life support equipment were still functioning, but he was quite dead. The autopsy promptly conducted by Dr. Yang aboard the Mars 2 craft found the cause of death to be a cerebral hemorrhage. Tolbukhin shook his head when he heard the verdict.
He died of fright, muttered the Russian. He died of Deimos. Dread.
Sol 9. Evening. He died of natural causes, then? Jamie said.
Voznesensky shrugged. But would he have died if he had remained on Earth, or if he had not gone on the EVA?
Jamie shrugged back at the Russian.
We'll never know.
They were in the cramped confines of the airlock, slowly, laboriously pulling themselves out of their hard suits, tired from the day's work, depressed by the news from orbit.
I still don't see why Lee had to order us to return to base, Jamie grumbled. Doesn't he understand what we found here?
What have we found? Voznesensky smiled tolerantly. An optical illusion?
Well, maybe, Jamie admitted.
When we get back to the base, we can ask the team in orbit for computer enhancement of the videotapes.
If there is any chance that the rock formations are man-made,